All right. Well, we are in security land again, and we have Dr. Jeremy Masler with us, the Maz. Fellow you've seen him before. But welcome back to Channel 9.
Good to be here, Charles.
And we're all going to have a conversation here with the special guest, Scott Field. Tell us about yourself. What do you do?
So I'm an architect in the security technology unit, and I've actually been working on security at Microsoft for about 12 years now. And I've seen a lot of changes. You know, back when I joined the development team, there were probably 20 people across development, test, and program management focused on security in the operating system. Hmm. And today we have hundreds of people working on security. That's certainly a huge change that we've seen there in terms of our priorities around security. And we've certainly seen a number of new threats and problems show up in the ecosystem that we've focused a lot of attention on. So I'm looking at security, and a lot of the recent focus is around protecting the operating system kernel.
Excellent.
That's been a huge focus area in Vista and also around the X64 platform. So that's my short-term, immediate focus right now.
So let's talk about that. I mean, it's sort of obvious to those of us in the know who kind of understand how operating systems work and et cetera, but for most people, why does it matter to lock down the kernel?
Yeah, so you can look at this from a number of different perspectives. So the first one, and the fairly obvious one to most people, would be that the kernel sits at the core of the system. So everything that the user does, you know, simple things like clicking on an icon, opening up a Word document, browsing to a website, all of those activities ultimately boil down to some operation occurring in the kernel. And actually, in many cases, many operations in the kernel. Mm-hmm. So everything you do that allocates a piece of memory is likely going to end up down in the kernel at some point in time. So everything is relying on the kernel. You know, that's an obvious good starting premise. The other way to look at this is from the perspective of the changing attack trends that we've seen. So if you go back a couple of years in time to a point where you started, when you first started to see anti-spyware products show up on the market, we saw three or four products on the market probably 2 years back, and these products were responding to very specific new threats. So keyboard loggers, targeted marketing, some of these threats that arose from spyware were responded to by these relatively simplistic products. Mm. And those products actually, for the most part, operated in user mode. And what we saw happen really was several things. One was the attacks, because they were financially motivated, people were making a lot of money on these things, they evolved the attacks pretty quickly. Mm. And one of the big things we saw shift here was really an escalation in terms of this bad spyware moving from running in user space to running in kernel space. And what that allowed these guys to do was basically thwart these security products on the market. They were able to hide from view of these security products and pretty much take over the whole system. And they're able to do that because they're essentially tampering with the kernel and having the kernel lie about, you know, very basic operations that are occurring in the system. Like something like, tell me the contents of this directory. Well, the bad guy has patched those routines and changed them to return different results or to filter himself out of the list. So from that perspective, if the attacker gets control of the kernel, they can basically affect everything on the system. And this is a situation that we realize that if it continued, if it escalated, we could get to a point where these threats become so common, so pervasive, that dealing with them after the fact becomes very complex or very time-consuming for the end user, for example. So those are kind of two viewpoints on the kernel. So one is it's basically the basis of everything that happens in the system. if something goes wrong there, you're basically hosed. Mm-hmm. So that's one reason why we've focused a lot of energy in that area.
Okay.
So what's, I mean, from a typical end user standpoint, security concern might be, hey, I'm going to sit down at this computer, I'm going to log into my bank website or into my stock account website. I want to make sure that when I type in my password, it's going just to that website and no one else is able to sniff it. Mm-hmm. So from a security perspective, how do you enforce that and sort of reassure the user that it's the password's only going to that site that needs it?
Yeah, so this particular problem spans many parts of the system. So one, clearly if I go back to the kernel-oriented attacks, a bad guy in the kernel space has access potentially to the keyboard driver and all the state that relates to the keyboard. So that's another reason why we want to, you know, have some controls around the kernel. So in the absence of that solution, you have other things to worry about. So one is the trustworthiness of the application itself. Are you really running the web browser? Has the web browser been tampered with? What's the definition of the web browser? Is it just internetexplorer.exe, or is it, you know, iExplorer.exe plus all of this additional code that's brought into the picture? So who really has access to it from the perspective of the application?
And just for those who don't know the architecture of Explorer, iExplorer.exe is actually a relatively small fraction of the what we think of as the browser. Right? When you said extra files, you're talking about Yrlmon and...
Correct. Yeah, iExplorer is almost a stub relative to the size of everything else that's brought in, let alone things like, you know, ActiveX controls, browser helper objects, and the like. So one thing that we have to understand is what is the application, what makes up the application that's actually handling this credential material that you're talking about. And we've actually done some work in Vista to help identify at least operating system components for starters. So everything that we ship in the operating system is digitally signed. And various actions in the system will take that into consideration. Things even like UAC elevation, when an elevation occurs, will tell the user about who the signer was behind that program. So identifying the program is one step. And then there are other activities such as identifying the flow of the credential material. So Windows Vista actually has a feature called the Credential Manager, which is a common API and UI framework for handling credentials. And there have actually been a number of improvements to that infrastructure for Vista that allow, you know, more trustworthy and predictable handling of credentials. So there's a common piece of UI that users would expect to see that's raised by the credential manager. There's also a mechanism that allows us to gather some credentials securely on the secure desktop as opposed to the desktop surface that users are interacting with normally.
Okay, well, so there's lots. I'm going to make a little list for myself. Sure. There's things to dig into. UAC, Credman, Secure Desktop, these are all things we probably want to dig into.
Sure.
All right, so good, secure ways to get the credentials.
Yeah, so then of course another piece is where is the credential going? So you've typed it into the browser, assume you know that, you know, the browser is good, the browser hasn't been tampered with, and when I say the browser, I mean the whole platform that defines the browser. Then you ask the question, where is the credential going when it hits the wire? Is it going to the wire over a secure protocol, for example? Is it going over SSL or not? And there are actually a lot of new controls in the browser that help users better handle credentials. And then, of course, there are situations like, is this really a banking site or not? So it's actually fairly straightforward for third parties to get SSL-enabled certificates. They can bring up a website, and they could perhaps bring up a website that has a very similar name to a legitimate financial institution, but it really isn't legitimate. So that's another problem that we've looked at. And this is basically... led to the evolution of certificate usage in the ecosystem. So we now have the notion of high assurance certificates that are assigned to financial institutions, for example. And when you use those, there's actually a differentiated user experience, for example, in the browser. So when I think about the credential scenario that you outlined, there's really kind of a life cycle that I think about when we worry about where's the risk to the credential, where's the risk to the user, how do we cue the user to what's happening with the credential, and then how do we enforce that it's flowing only to the, you know, the appropriate party. And then also, under the covers, how does the system ensure that that credential isn't being handled by code that doesn't need it, that doesn't need access to it? And in some cases, what we can do there is we can say that, well, the system, there's a system component that, that prompts for your credential, and then it may encrypt it with a key that's specific to that system boot, and then it flows through all these intermediate components until it reaches the end entity. So that's one actual way we deal with breaking kind of the references across components. The components still get to handle it, but what they're handling isn't actually usable. They're just acting as basically a dumb pipe. So that's another thing that we've looked at to reduce exposure to user credentials.
All right, so let's try and just dig into it. So you talked lots of pieces that come into play there. So the first one you mentioned was going back to the kernel and saying, look, if you don't trust the kernel, someone could sniff your keystrokes, or presumably they could sniff the network access.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you protect against that?
So, well, a couple of things that we've done in Vista are really driving anonymity out of the kernel. So one of the big things that we've done for 64-bit x64 systems in Vista is we've said that all code that loads into the kernel has to be identified, A, so you have to be able to tell where the code came from, and then B, we'll actually verify at load time that the code hasn't been modified since it was signed by the original author of the code. So by doing that, what we've done is we've kind of driven out anonymity from the kernel. So now at least the user is in a position to identify what's running in the kernel. And then things like Windows Defender and other third-party security solutions, they have a better chance of being able to identify the good from the bad, if you will. So one situation that we have today with malicious software, for example, let's take a malicious keyboard driver. Pre-Vista, there were no expectations around that piece of software being digitally signed. So if a bad guy produced a bad keyboard driver and released it, there was no digital signature attached. And moreover, once it's out there, other people can modify that driver, maybe in a subtle way, such that it's no longer considered malicious by, for example, an antivirus product. So it's very easy to create permutations of a released driver. And there's no digital signing around that, so you can do that indefinitely. And to revoke, if you will, all those drivers, you're going to have to stay on top of every single permutation that's out there. So to stop that driver, you have to know about all of them, stay on top of it, which is kind of a reactive, endless game. With code signing in the picture, that there's actually it adds a nice level of indirection in that if I come to know that a particular signing key has been misused, you know, and it's been used to sign malware, what I can do is I can, you know, ask the question, should I revoke that key? Should all software signed by that key no longer be allowed to load, for example? So that's one thing we can do. And the other thing we can do, of course, is that it's much more efficient to maintain lists of, you know, good publishers versus, you know, publishers that have gone bad potentially or started bad. So that's one thing we can get there, is we can get a good inventory of the system. The user can tell where the software came from, and they can also tell if the software has been tampered with. Now, that's a step in the right direction, but it doesn't really tell us if a legitimate vendor has produced a driver that may have bugs in it. So you might have a driver that's out there that you know, unbeknownst to the person that wrote it, it could be misused for some purpose, like capturing keyboard keystrokes. Maybe I have a USB device, for example, that I plug in, and it works fine and dandy under normal circumstances, but maybe there's a hole there that lets me exploit it. So digital signing doesn't help us at all with that type of situation. The case where we do have, you know, some visibility into that is really programs, certification programs like WCCL, where driver vendors submit their binaries to Microsoft. They run a bunch of tests, and from those tests, we can sometimes tell, you know, if something is likely to go wrong there.
And WCCL is the Windows Hardware.
It's the Quality Labs, yeah. So that's really just a start. It doesn't solve the entire problem. It at least brings identification and integrity to the existing kernel mode code, but it doesn't say that, well, that code is good, is bug-free, it can't be misused. That's right now something that we don't have a good general-purpose solution for.
So I have two questions. A, why only 64-bit? I don't see why there's a memory requirement for patch guard. And second, what's all the noise that's going on about this? I mean, what does it mean to me as a software vendor that I now have to have my driver signed in order to run in Windows? And what does it also mean for runtime kernel code? If I want to run some code in kernel at runtime from my application, what does that mean to me?
Yeah, so actually I'll address...
two questions.
Yeah, well, actually I'll address the 64-bit question with two pieces of tech. I'll address two pieces of technology because there's really patch guard and there's the driver signing work. So the driver signing work is actually new for Vista.
Okay.
Pre-Vista, we never had a requirement around digitally signing code kernel space. It was recommended, but not enforced. The only place where you saw that really surface pre-Vista was the plug-and-play install dialog, which, ironically, you go out to Best Buy and buy a new printer, you read the manual, and it has a photograph of the unsigned driver dialog, and it tells the user just to click OK. So that's really the only place where you saw code signing surface for drivers pre-Vista. So for Vista, we've just said that it's mandatory.
Okay.
So, and that's enforced at load time.
And that's x64 and 32-bit?
No, so that's x64 only. Okay. And the reason for that is really around application compatibility. So as I mentioned, a lot of legitimate software included drivers that were not digitally signed and, in fact, instructed users, you know, just click through the bad dialog box. And we actually did, we took a look at the data. So the OCA, the Online Crash Analysis team here at Microsoft, looks at kernel crashes, you know, on a daily basis. So they have a lot of data on what drivers are out there. And there are hundreds of thousands, roughly, of unsigned 32-bit drivers out there. So for us to turn on that that option on 32-bit would probably be pretty catastrophic. You know, most of the driver software out there would stop working. So we said, well, 64-bit, X64 is new. There were roughly, when we looked at the data for XP 64-bit edition and Windows 2003 Server X64, we looked at that data and there were roughly 1,000 drivers out there, and the majority of those drivers were digitally signed already. Many of them were provided in box, or many of them, the companies were working very closely with WCCL, for example. A lot of the machines were server class machines where there's a, you know, higher expectation around driver quality. So we didn't really have that application compatibility burden to worry about. 64-bit, so we said this is a good time to do it. If we didn't do this in Vista, we would probably be having the same conversation that we had with 32-bit down the road, and that as well. There are, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of drivers that are unsigned out there. We can't do anything. So, that's
so you have to, for 64-bit, you have to rewrite your driver anyways, because a 32-bit driver won't work on 64-bit, so Yeah. If you have to rewrite it, you may as well.
Yeah, I would say you probably don't need to rewrite it per se. You at least need to recompile it. Okay. And there are a lot of common issues like the size of pointers and, you know, should I be using a D word or, you know, a UN64? You know, those questions aren't really rewrite class issues, but you at least have to recompile it. Mm-hmm. The other thing that we are telling ISVs is that when you digitally sign your 64-bit drivers, just go ahead and digitally sign your 32-bit drivers as well. You may as well, you know, don't fork your build environment, just do everything consistently. And that may position the ecosystem in such a way where we might enable this down the road for 32-bit. And it might be enabled through something like an opt-in mechanism. Like, mm-hmm. I'm installing a bunch of new machines that an OEM shipped, like Dell or HP. I know they only have the latest and greatest drivers on them. They're all digitally signed. Maybe I'll opt into that for 32-bit. That's something we're very open to doing.
Okay. So is there, on Vista 32, is there a benefit for a driver company to sign their 32-bit driver? I mean, I'm already noticing with some drivers that they were on XP, assuming that they didn't have to worry about being signed, right? And they were doing some, they're making some call or changing some value in their code where they're now, XP doesn't recognize them as being a device. So there's actually is some changes that 32-bit driver developers have to make if they're making a bad assumption about being signed and not signed.
Yeah, there's certainly changes in the driver model in certain areas in Vista. That might be what you're seeing there. But in terms of benefits to 32-bit drivers, there are quite a number of benefits. So one is you definitely get a better install UX experience. So the old ugly unsigned driver dialog need not pop up. So if you sign your code, you're going to get a much better UX experience mm-hmm. for the end user. That's one benefit. The other benefit is around identification of crashes and faults in the system. So if your driver is digitally signed and properly identified, if Microsoft, through the online crash analysis phase, determines that crashes are occurring because of your driver, Microsoft can actually, can reach out to the vendor and get those problems addressed. And then the other one is really around other more subtle UX issues. So I mentioned before that some parts of the system will differentiate the digitally signed experience. Mm-hmm. So you'll benefit from that for free.
Cool.
And then if we provide an opt-in mechanism down the road, as I mentioned, mm-hmm. no new work for you as well. So that's another benefit.
Very cool. Now, is there any way for, as an admin, to create a group policy that says only signed drivers are allowed to be installed on the system?
Yeah. So actually, there was a feature added. I don't remember the exact name of the feature, but there was a feature added to Vista that provides enterprises with that level of control. And I believe it might be even as granular as, only drivers from this specific set of vendors, for example.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Right, and so if you are, I think your second part of Charles, your question was, if you are a software and you're an ISV who's building something that requires some kernel mode components or services, the guidance under Vista is just make sure you sign them?
Yeah, digitally signed code, and there's a great paper on the Windows Hardware and Devices site on Microsoft.com that really enumerates what it takes to do that. And we've really simplified the signing program in terms of all you really have to do is get a valid Class 3 code signing key, and then there's a range of certification authorities that are allowed to issue those keys. So it's pretty straightforward. There's kind of a one-time pain in terms of integrating that into your build environment and your process. But once it's done, it's pretty low cost. Certainly Microsoft, for a number of years now, we've been digitally signing everything. And Windows, of course, is comprised of just thousands and thousands of binaries. Those are all digitally signed prior to release. So,
very cool. So we have a bunch of things on the list to
well, jump I was thinking maybe we should sort of keep walking through the things we were talking about when you first explained that password. I think that'll get to a lot of things.
Right. Yeah, so certainly. I touched on the 64-bit kernel signing topic. Didn't address the patch guard issue with you yet.
Which is also 64-bit only.
It is 64-bit only. And this feature was actually introduced prior to Vista, so we introduced patch guard in the very first version of the Windows system that supports the x64 architecture running in 64-bit mode. Mm-hmm. And the two operating system variants that first appeared in were the Windows XP x64 edition and the Windows 2003 x64 edition.
Okay.
And you'd asked before, you know, why 64-bit only there? And the first reason is quite similar to why we did this for driver signing, and that is that there's some accumulated application compatibility burden associated with 32-bit. So we took a look at, you know, who was patching the kernel and why, and it turns out there's an interesting mix of people that are patching the kernel on 32-bit systems. There are legitimate security vendors, for example, that have been patching the kernel. And there are also some malicious guys patching the kernel as well. Clearly, we're not really concerned about the malicious guys. I would be very happy to break it for them, but breaking existing code on 32-bit is something you have to look at very carefully. So that was the primary reason why it didn't appear on 32-bit. There were some secondary issues really around the security of the solution. So there are some very subtle behaviors of, for example, the AMD CPU and the architecture of PE images on Windows that basically don't afford the same level of security in the patch guard implementation on 32-bit versus 64-bit. So the solution, even if we did make it available there, wouldn't be as secure as the 64-bit solution. some people have asked, is this something that you would consider implementing for 32-bit later on? Right now, we don't have any real plans for doing that. It may be something that we could provide an opt-in mechanism for at some future time where, by customer choice, you can turn it on. We haven't really committed to that at this time. So.
But, I mean, the only thing that I would say is x64 is the future, clearly. So you're still going to have to deal with the compatibility of these 32-bit applications running on a 64-bit platform that's patch guard enabled. Will you not have the same issues? Will they also break?
Well, so I think as you touched on earlier, all of the 32-bit driver code that was patching the kernel in the past, by definition, would have to be at least recompiled to run on 64-bit. So, and in particular, in this case, it's probably much more invasive than just being recompiled, because a lot of these patching techniques are very CPU architecture specific. So if you're looking at the stack, for example, the code to do that is very different on, you know, x64 operating environment versus a 32-bit environment. So the code would have to be recompiled, and it would likely have to be re-engineered in some ways. In some ways, that may be non-trivial. In other ways, it may be fairly simplistic. So by definition, this existing 32-bit software that we saw patching the kernel did not work on 64-bit anyway. So it was really a clean slate. So you've got a clean slate here. How do we start, you know, an environment where these patching practices, which were never really supported or documented, how do we get out of that game? So how do we change the game from the perspective of making the system more secure and more reliable? And this was a big way to affect that change.
And I mean, part of what you're saying is that we're making the system more understandable by making it less undocumented.
Correct. Yeah, so just having an inventory of the code that's running in the kernel is a big thing. So one of the things we looked at, you know, the people that were patching the kernel, one of the common approaches that was utilized was to basically point service descriptor table calls into non-page pool memory. So instead of the call vectoring into the kernel image, the NTOS kernel image, it's now vectoring off into some piece of memory that was allocated out of non-page pool, which isn't even backed by a loaded device driver. So in that particular case, you look at the system, and you're looking at this piece of memory, and it's not backed by any specific DLL, so who did it? You know, how do I discover what code was responsible for that? You know, how does the system behave if somebody else comes along, you know, and tries to patch the same routine? What's the order of the calls that happen? What happens when somebody removes themselves from that call chain? It becomes very unpredictable and unreliable in that circumstance, not to mention that there's really no inventory of what's running anymore, which is really a situation that is more like malware, you know, a situation created by malware versus a situation where you've got legitimate software running that's easily discoverable by the end user. So that was another problem, yeah, that we indeed wanted to see go away.
Absolutely. But, I mean, just to be clear, on 32-bit Vista, you could still, unfortunately, install software that runs in the kernel that you don't know is running, that the system doesn't know is running. Are we saying that we would, I mean, because it doesn't have to be signed, right? Or let's just talk about it, because I'm sort of a paranoid user, and mm-hmm. one of my worst fears has always been like rootkits.
Yep.
And stuff's going on, you have no way of detecting it, you can't detect it with Process Manager, you could write code and try to detect it, but that's not easy for most people. So that really freaks me out. I mean, stuff running that I can't know that's running, the system doesn't know that's running, and that could be doing God knows what.
Yeah, it can do anything, basically.
So let's talk, I mean, we have addressed that a little bit. I mean, I'm not trying to take away this whole, the point is it just signing code that disables that to happen, or what other kind of innovations are going on?
Yeah, so like I said before, signing code is really just a start. That's really to help identify the software uh-huh. and prove that the software hasn't been modified since it was shipped by the vendor. Okay. So the role of PatchGuard is really to prevent unauthorized modifications of the kernel image itself and then critical data structures that dramatically influence the kernel, like the interrupt dispatch table is a good one. So PatchGuard is in the business of enforcing, you know, that very, very straightforward policy that says nobody can play with these resources.
Okay.
Beyond that, we're looking at a number of other improvements down the road. So one is around virtualization features. So we've got a team at Microsoft working on a hypervisor, mm-hmm. And this is an area where we thought that changes like PatchGuard are goodness today. So PatchGuard is in the kernel today. It's running, unfortunately, it's running in the same security domain that it's protecting today. Mm-hmm. So a malicious guy might be able to find a way to turn it off, for example. And we think about those cases from time to time. And whenever somebody reports such a case, we generally respond and update PatchGuard. But because it's in the same security domain, it's, you know, it's going to be subject to those attacks periodically. Mm-hmm. If we move to a hypervisor-based world, this gives us the opportunity to actually move that implementation to the hypervisor. So the PatchGuard implementation could be in a hypervisor, which means that it's no longer in the same security domain that it's protecting. So you could have a case, for example, where you've got a bunch of code loaded into memory, and that could be the kernel and other images, and you can now say that with a hypervisor that the pages of memory that back that code can't be modified. Whereas today you have a situation whereby the page table entry attributes that, you know, define whether a page is readable, writable, executable, etc., those attributes can be modified from inside the kernel. So if we had that logic, if you will, moved into the hypervisor can now use the CPU to say that, well, these pages are read-only for real. And if somebody inside the kernel that's being hosted inside the guest partition they try and modify those page table entry attributes, it'll just fail. So that's an area where we're looking very hard at that in terms of what does it mean for PatchGuard and what does it mean for other code that's running in the kernel. The other question that is related to that is sort of covered by the NX technology to some degree. So the NX and DEP technology says that in order to execute code, it has to be in a page that's marked as executable. If it isn't, it just faults. So there are some things we can do down the road from Vista to leverage that even further.
Cool.